All right, we're ready for Mark 15. We are in the last section of the book, the events at Jerusalem, and subdividing that, we are ready here to deal with the section of death. There was the teaching that last week, the trial. We are still in the trial section, but this focuses on his death in chapter 15. And then next week, we'll look at his resurrection. Let's review our chapters of where we've been. Chapter 1, the beginning of the Galilean ministry. Chapter 2, early on, Mark starts this. Conflict with the Pharisees, painting a picture of that conflict. That conflict is exhibited in chapter 3. Controversy over the Sabbath. Chapter 4 moves to what Matthew 13 talks about. Parables, chapter 5, three miracles, there's evidence of who he is. Chapter 6, Matthew 14, I'm giving parallels to help as a reminder. John beheaded, more miracles. Chapter 7, more controversy, the eating with unwashed hands. Chapter 8, Mark seems to be driving at a point, comes to it now. Peter's confession that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Connecting that with chapter 1, verse 1, the point of the book, we'll make more about that later with reference to the centurion. Chapter 9, Matthew 17, parallel. Transfiguration and relationships, Matthew 18. Mark 10, divorce and remarriage. Parallel is Matthew 19, very good. And then chapter 11, the triumphal entry. Now, so this is where we start that Passion Week, or the last week in the life of Christ. We start that here in Matthew 11. So Mark gets to it early, gets to it quick. Chapter 12. All right, parable of the vine dressers and the exchange of questions. That was on Tuesday of that week. We'll get to that in a moment. Then chapter 13, parallel to Matthew 24, is the destruction of Jerusalem. And then chapter 14, we looked at last 2 weeks. His betrayal, his arrest, and his trials. Question number one for today, what's chapter 15 about? All right, trials and crucifixion is what we're dealing with. We'll see this again, this calendar. Next week, and then we'll be done till we get toward the end of Luke, and then we'll be done with it till we get toward the end of John. Be that as it may, this is where we are, the highlighted section on Friday. So if you are making marginal notes, trying to keep up with the days, starting with chapter 11, on being on Sunday, we've given various days, and you probably don't have Wednesday flagged in Mark. We will in Luke. And so we are on Friday. This is where his arrest is, in the early hours of Friday, and the trial and then the crucifixion. Make sense? So we're going to be on Friday all day today, and all chapter 15. Next, we skip Saturday because that's a day in the tomb, and then the next scene is chapter 16 on the first day of the week, which is the day he was raised from the dead. So if you're marking that, mark Friday for all of chapter 15. All right, here's what happens in Mark 15. We have continuation of the trials, and then we have the mockery of Jesus, his crucifixion, and his burial, and the chapter closes, and we're ready for the resurrection in chapter 16 next time. Make sense? All right, let's make some sense of the trials. We have him before the Sanhedrin. And that's the third hearing. So if you're making marginal notes, you might make a note that at verse 1a, first part of verse 1, is he's before the Sanhedrin, but that's the third hearing. We'll make sense of that if that doesn't make sense to you. Then we have him before Pilate, verse 1b through 5, and then we have him before Pilate again. Because there was something that happened between verse 5 and verse 6. And that's found in Luke and only in Luke. Okay? Making sense? We're going to make, we'll parse all of that out here as we go along. So let's talk about where we are. Parallel accounts, I'm not going to focus a great deal on the parallel accounts. We will draw them in, but not as we often have done, and you'll see why. Now, I'll remind you of this again, because I hope this gets fixed in your mind. When we talk about the trial of Jesus, he didn't just go on trial and then the trial is over. There are two trials with three hearings each. You've heard me say that multiple times. The last time I flagged three points that are found in Mark, actually there are four. The first one of these is not found in Mark. So Mark doesn't talk about going before Annas. We'll talk about him in just a second. Mark does mention before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin in the middle of the night, and then in the early hours of the morning, that's where we are, starting at Mark 15:1. So when I said the third hearing, verse 1, that's what we're talking about. It's the Jewish trial and the third hearing. That's where we're starting. Then they move to the Roman trial. We have him going before Pilate in verse 1b. And so Mark mentions that. Mark doesn't mention Herod Antipas. In Luke chapter 23, 6 to 12, Mark does mention the last. So Mark mentions four of the six. He skips two. Make sense? So to get the complete picture of the trial, then we have to take all the accounts. All right, let's see what's happened. Let's get the picture. There was this first hearing after his arrest. He went before Annas. He's the former high priest. And I'm not going to spend much time with that. John is the only one who talks about that, and it was not much of a trial. None of these were much of a trial. Take him before Annas, and he questions him about his disciples and his doctrine. They struck him, and Jesus said he taught openly, and if I've done evil, what evidence is it? Why did you strike me? And that's about all happens in that trial. Then Mark does pay attention to the second hearing in the middle of the night before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. The full Sanhedrin council hasn't met. And evidence of that's going to be found in Mark 15:1. We'll get to that in a second. And so there was false testimony about the temple. Caiaphas asked him what response. Jesus was silent. Caiaphas asked him if he's the Son of God. He said yes. Caiaphas said that's blasphemy. We don't need more witness. What do you think? And they said he's worthy of death. They blindfolded him, spat on him, beat him, and they struck him. And now we're ready for the official Sanhedrin meeting in Mark 15:1. Make sense? All right, here's how we're going to do this. We're going to go to Mark 15 and look at the account here, and then we'll get the summary of the combined accounts. Make sense? All right. Now, let me suggest something to you about Mark's account of the trials. Let me save that till we get to Pilate, because there's several things that he leaves out. And let's get this Sanhedrin at verse 1. That immediately in the morning, this makes it official, because the meeting in the night is not legal, as if anything's legal here. It's not formal, is maybe the better way of wording that, until the morning, until the whole council. So verse 1 said that the elders and the scribes and the whole council. So that suggests to me the whole council hadn't met together. There wasn't enough to make it a full council meeting. We're all in agreement. Do you have any evidence that the whole council was in agreement? There's evidence in our text, not at verse 1, but before we get through, start watching for that. There's evidence that the whole council did not agree. And we'll talk about that when we get to that. So kind of be watching for that. We don't know that from verse 1. It said the whole council met together, and it seems as if they're all in agreement. They're not all in agreement. Not everybody's voting in the same direction. And so then they bound him and sent him off to Pilate. Making sense? All right, now the other accounts add a little bit to that. In this hearing, this is going to be the end of the Jewish trial. So this is the third. They've gone before Annas and then Caiaphas during the night, and the portion of the Sanhedrin, now the full Sanhedrin again. And they ask, "Are you the Christ?" And Jesus answers, "If I tell you, you won't believe. If I ask you, you won't answer. Let me go." And he claimed to be the Son of God. "Well, are you the Son of God?" He said, "I am." We don't need any further witness. We can't carry out the sentence, and so we go to the Romans. So why do they go to Pilate? Well, we're not told here, but John 18:31 is going to help us with that, if you might turn over there. So the Jews are the ones wanting to kill him, so why don't they just do that? And the Jews said to Pilate in John 18:31, it is not lawful for us to put anyone to death. The Romans wouldn't let them execute without their approval. So they've got to go to the Romans to get the Romans committed to putting him to death. Make sense? That's why we got to have a Roman trial. The Jews, if they could, would have already killed him, but they can't do that. They've got to go before the Romans. So we're now ready for the Roman trial. Now let's talk about what Mark doesn't mention here. Mark's account of the trial before Pilate is the briefest of all the accounts before Pilate. In other words, all the other accounts say more than Mark does. Mark gives an abbreviated discussion about the kingdom that we read about in John 18. He talks briefly, but he doesn't say a lot. He excludes the early conclusion of Pilate that there is no fault in Jesus, John 18. He skips the symbolized washing of the hands. Remember that, Matthew, where he washes his hands and he's innocent? Mark doesn't mention that. He omits sending him to Herod. We're going to flag that here in a moment. He just skips that. So he has the most abbreviated version of Pilate's trial of all the accounts. Does that make sense? All right. So let's talk about him being before Pilate. Now, it's going to be verses 1 to 5, and then we're going to add the rest of that a little bit later. But let's start at verse 1b. They delivered him to Pilate. And so we have a question in Mark's account, an accusation, and another question. What's the first question? Are you king of the Jews? That was the charge, that he claims to be king of the Jews. And his answer was, it's as you say, yes. Now, this is interesting because they're not thinking king of the Jews in the sense of a spiritual kingdom, are they? That's not the accusation they're making. They're trying to make a charge. Here's a man who claims to be king. He's trying to be an insurrectionist. He's trying to lead and establish a kingdom. He claims to be king. That's going to be interesting in a moment. At the second hearing before Pilate, isn't it? The inconsistency. We'll get to that in a second. Now then, there's an accusation. What is it? Or what's said about it, the accusation at verse 3? All right, accused him of many things. Like what? Well, let's go over here to point 3. They accused him of perverting the nation. We're getting this from Matthew, Luke, and John. Perverting the nation, forbidding to pay tax, and saying he's king. So they accused him of various things. Anything they could pin on him, they try to pin on him. And Jesus' response is to be silent. Next question, verse 4. Yeah, are you not going to answer? You're not going to say anything? And Jesus was silent. And Pilate's reaction to this, he is absolutely amazed that no answer is being given. Absolutely amazed. Now, we'll say more about that perhaps in a moment. So let's harmonize the accounts and see what we've got in this fourth hearing. This is the first of the Roman trial. Pilate said, "What accusation?" And their answer was, if you want an evil doer, we wouldn't have brought him. It's like calling the police and say, arrest this man. Well, what did he do wrong? Well, I wouldn't have called you if he hadn't done something wrong, so go ahead and arrest him. That doesn't tell you the charge. What a sham of a trial. Pilate said, you judge him according to your law. So they said, he's perverting the nation, forbidding to pay tax, etc. Are you king? And he answered, yes. Do you hear what they say? And he asked, what is truth? And then he walked out. And Pilate said, I find no fault with him. Mark doesn't mention that. Pilate keeps making that point repeatedly. I don't find any fault with him. All right. You might make a marginal note between verse 5 and verse 6. That's where this fits in. So between verse 5 and 6, there is a hearing before Herod Antipas. And only Luke talks about that. So we'll get that in Luke. So we're not going to turn over there and read that. Let's get a summary right here. So Pilate says, I find no fault with him. He sends him off to Herod because he don't know what to do. There is no evidence of criminal action or wrongdoing. So he sends him off to Herod Antipas, king. And Herod asks questions. Jesus didn't answer. The chief priest and the scribes vehemently accused him. Herod and his men treated Jesus with contempt and mocked him. And there started some friendship now between Herod and Pilate. And he sends him back to Pilate. Now, these are approximate times. And what I want you to get the picture is we started about midnight. And we're now about 5:30 or 6 in the morning. And we're in our fifth hearing. We're headed toward our sixth hearing. By 9 o'clock, he's going to be on the cross. By 9 o'clock. So if you could imagine someone being arrested midnight last night, and he's already been through six hearings, and he's already on the cross by this hour. That's a pretty speedy trial. All right, now we're ready for the final hearing, and this is before Pilate again, starting at verse 6. All right, let's go to our text now, and then we'll come back to our harmony. And Mark doesn't say a whole lot about all of the rest that we find on the screen here in a moment. What's going on at verse 6? There's a custom. Releasing a prisoner at the feast. The feast is not identified. That would be the feast of the Passover. That was customary. Whomever they requested would be released. There was a man named Barabbas. Now let's look at what he's done. There are three things that he's mentioned. Two here, and we'll add one from John. He was chained with his fellow insurrectionists. What's an insurrectionist? Stirs up strife, trying to overthrow the government. Isn't that the charge they've made against Jesus? He's claiming to be king of the Jews. He's a threat to the Romans. He's claiming he's king. Here was a man who actually tried to overthrow the government. Not only that, he's done something else. He's committed murder. John 18:40, you might make a marginal note, he's also a robber. And so he's a thief, he's dishonest, he's a murderer, and he's an insurrectionist. And we want him released. And so verse 8, they cried aloud, or they were going up, literally, began to ask to do what you've always done. And he said, and so before, much is said, that's kind of in the background, there's this man over here named Barabbas. Since this is their custom, they said, are you going to release someone? And so he makes the proposal, do you want me to release Jesus, King of the Jews? And of course their answer is no. Look at verse 10. For he knew the chief priest had handed him over because of envy. What does that suggest to you? Yeah, I think it is. Here is a man, Jesus, who has built a large crowd following him. Now, has the crowd dwindled some? Yeah. Many of the disciples turned to walk no more with him, John 6. That's true. But there's still a crowd. There's still a multitude following him. He comes to Jerusalem, and there's a big stir. Remember, they wanted to take him, but they were fearful of the crowd. And so he had influenced, he had earned a reputation and gained a following that they had not. There's not a single one of the chief priests could walk out and have the crowd. And so they're envious of him. And they had delivered him because of that. And so they stirred up the crowd that they should ask for Barabbas. And so verse 12, here's a question he asked. What do you want me to do with him who is king of the Jews? Notice he keeps calling him king of the Jews. And that's the charge he's going to make at verse 26 over his head. And they cried out again, crucify him. Luke adds an emphasis to that. Crucify him, crucify him. Doubled for emphasis. Now then, what does Pilate ask? Why? What evil has he done? And so their answer is, just crucify him. They're not going to give the specifics. So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them, and he delivered Jesus after he had scourged him. We'll come back to the scourging in a moment to be crucified. Let's talk about what Pilate seems to be trying to do here. Before we do that, let's get the overall picture, and then I'm going to come back and talk about what Pilate did. Pilate had said, I'm harmonizing all the accounts, that I find no fault with him. He brings Jesus out and says, behold the man. He says, there's no fault. The Jews said, we've got a law, he ought to die. Well, he asked Jesus, where are you from? Pilate wanting to release him, but they threatened that you're not Caesar's friend. Pilate asked, who should I release? His wife said, have nothing to do with this man. The people said, release Barabbas. He asked, what fault? And what shall I do with the Christ? They said, crucify him. What evil has he done? Well, crucify him. Pilate washed his hands. Remember that symbolic washing of hands Matthew mentions. And then Pilate presents him saying, behold the king. He scourged him and then delivered him to be crucified. Now, I want to talk about this scourging here. And then add a comment of why he may have done that. The scourging involved often tying a man to a post or something wherein his back is stretched and tight, and then taking some kind of whip or whips that had many faceted prongs to that, and then tied either pieces of bone or stone, and then would give them lashes and then jerk that so that it just fillets and cuts open the back. So it's not just a matter of taking like a bullwhip and whipping a man. It's taking this, and then as you jerk that, it cuts the back, and then he hits him again, and it cuts the back, and then it hits him again, and he cuts the back. And so Pilate scourged him. That often could end in death, but it did not always. Let's add a couple of thoughts here. Why did Pilate do that? This is some conjecture, I recognize. But it seems like Pilate may be trying to save the life of Jesus. Remember, he keeps asking, what fault has he done? Y'all see to him. Well, what's he done wrong? What's the charge? What about me releasing him to you? And so you say, well, why does he beat him then? Why didn't he just release him? Well, he fears the crowd, for one thing. Let's go to John 19, 1-5. And then Pilate took him and he scourged him. And at verse 4, after doing that, he presents him saying, behold, I'm bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no fault with him. After scourging him, I want you to remember, I don't find anything wrong with this man. I find no fault, no reason for death. You say, okay, I got that. Let's go to Luke 23 and put another point. I think perhaps clinch that. Luke 23, 16. And Pilate said, I will therefore chastise him and release him. Now, I know I'm taking two and two, and I've come up with six. I've admitted there's some conjecture here, so you can figure out if the other two's there or not. Make sense? It seems to me that Pilate is thinking, I don't see any fault with this man. I've argued with them. They keep pushing back. They don't want me to release him. I think maybe if I scourge him and punish him and punish him severely, that may spare him and he may not have to go die. Is that the case? I don't know. I just throw that out for what it's worth. You say, I don't believe that. Okay, then I may be wrong. Just think about that and chew on that and accept it or reject it. All right. So here's what's happened now, and Mark just told us about four of those six hearings. Make sense? All right, let's talk about the mockery of Jesus. Starting at verse 16, they led him away to a hall called the Praetorium. Much discussion about this Praetorium. Where is that and what is that? And so you check about 20 commentaries, and about 10 of them are going to say that probably has reference to Herod's palace. And that's probably the Praetorium. And about the other half will say it's the fortress of Antonia. Which was it? I don't know. Not sure. Doesn't make a big difference, but the commentators have a lot to say about that, and I'll leave that for them to discuss. I'm not sure what we're going to gain by going through all of that. But nonetheless, there was a whole garrison. It's where the soldiers would have been gathered, from 600 to 1,000, some have argued. And what did they do with him? How did they mock him? Absolutely. Go back to verse 12. The charge was, he says he's king of the Jews. Pilate keeps calling him King of the Jews. All right? The charge that's going to be put over his head when they crucify him is King of the Jews. In other words, he claims to be King of the Jews. That's his charge. And so, okay, he claims to be king. We're going to honor him as king, quote. And so they put a purple robe. That's the color of kings. They put a thorn of crown upon his head that would cut up on his head, and they salute him, Hail, King of the Jews. It's all in mockery. You think you're king? Matthew says they put a reed in his hand. Mark doesn't mention that. A staff. A king has a staff. So they put a reed in his hand, and then they took it, and what did they do with it? They struck him with it. And then the height of hypocrisy, or the height of humbling a man, they spat on him, verse 19. And what else did they do? They bowed the knee, saying to him, they bowed the knee and they worshiped him. I'll come back to that in a moment. And when they mocked him, they took the purple robe, put his own clothes on, and led him out to be crucified. All right. Question number, where is it? Verse number 6. What do you learn from verse 19 about worship? All right, it's not true worship. They're bowing down and praising him. They're saying the right words to him. Yeah. Absolutely. It's done in mockery, and it's without the right spirit. Are they saying the right things? Hail, King of the Jews? Sure. Are they bowing before him? That's the right action, the right words, but the right spirit's not there. Is there a lesson in that for us? Could I be singing the right words? Could I be going through the right actions and not have the right spirit, and it be no different than this mockery? Does that make sense? That was a mockery. Sometimes ours is a mockery. I give my money, I take of the eat of the fruit of the vine and the unleavened bread, and I sat still while the prayer was going on, etc., and yet my mind is not involved. It could be no more better. That's not good English. It's not any better than what theirs was. All right, let's go on to the crucifixion now and talk about the case of the crucifixion. They led him, starting in verse 21, they compelled Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus. We don't know much more than that about Simon of Cyrene, who's coming through the country. They compelled him, forced him to carry the cross. And the place where they came was called Golgotha. The exact location, we don't know. Here's a map of Jerusalem. Some think that Golgotha is right there in my circle. Maybe so. Translated, it means a place of the skull. Some suggest, tradition says it had the resemblance or looked like a skull. Some of the hills and some of the rocks in that area. Called Calvary in the Latin translation by Jerome, and then appeared in Luke 23:33. It's called Calvary, same place. So he was crucified at Golgotha, place of the skull, Calvary, all having reference to the same place. Now, verse 24 said they divided his garments and cast lots for that. Now, here's some time frame we want to make a marginal note on it. Verse 25, it was the third hour. This is Jewish time, so that's about 9 a.m. I just want you to get a picture here as we run through this section. And so at verse 9, that'd be about 9 a.m. Arrested about midnight, and 9 hours later, he's been through 2 trials, 6 hearings, and he's on the cross. Make sense? What a sham of a trial. So the inscription put above his head said, King of the Jews. That was usually the inscription, so that you walk by and you see someone being crucified. This guy's a robber. This guy's a murderer. This guy's an insurrectionist. This guy's King of the Jews. That's interesting. Mark doesn't tell us about the controversy over that title. What was the controversy? Yeah, change that. And he refused to do that. And verse 27, there was robbers, one on one side, one on the left, and that fulfilled scripture, Isaiah 53. Now, I want to notice verse 29 through 32, this mockery that they made of Jesus, and then we're going to come to the timetable at verse 33 again. What I want to describe for you is before we look at that is the added severe test and the taunting and a severe trial of Jesus. Not only in the trials, but as he's hanging on the cross, for these things to be said. So there's two things I want you to focus on. One is how taunting and trying that was to Jesus, and his dedication to do God's will overrode any temptation there may have been to react. Does that make sense? So let's see what they said. Verse 29, what'd they say? Aha. In other words, this is ridicule, making fun of him. You said, so save yourself and come down from, if you can do that, save yourself and come down from the cross. Could he have done that? Sure he could, but he didn't. Now, verse 31, they said he saved others, himself he can't save. That had to be taunting to him. And then verse 32, let the Christ, the King of Israel, if he claims to be king, is what it says above his head, descend now from the cross that we may see and believe. In other words, we'll believe him if that's the case. Jesus knows better. They'd already seen miracles and rejected him. And those that were crucified with him reviled him. One translation said insulting to him. All right, verse 33. We're ready for another time, the sixth hour, that's about 12 noon. What happened at 12 noon until the ninth hour? Oh, okay, over all the land. Some translation may use the word nation. I take that to be the land of Judea, not over the whole earth, but where this is all taking place. The ninth hour would be 3 p.m., so those are your time frames. From 9 to 12, there's three statements that he makes on the cross. There's four more that he makes from 12 to 3, and from 12 to 3, there's darkness over the face of the earth. So we're looking at a 9 to 3 period here before he dies. Make sense? All right. Now then, let's go now to verse 34. At the ninth hour, he shouted out with a loud voice. It's about 3 p.m., Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. That's Aramaic, which means. All right, why have you forsaken me? I think that just simply means that God for a moment turned his back and allowed him to die, because without that death, there would be no sacrifice for the sin of mankind. And so why have you forsaken me? Then there is. They thought he was calling for Elijah. And so someone ran, and let's go back to verse 23. They had offered him wine mingled with myrrh to drink, but he didn't take it. This time at verse 36, someone filled a sponge of sour wine on a reed and lifted it up, and John 19:28 says he took it. Doesn't tell us that here. All right? And someone said, let him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes. There's more taunting. And then verse 37, what happens? Breathe his last breath and he's dead. Now, what happens when he dies? The veil of the temple was torn in two. The thickness of a man's hand was ripped from top to bottom. What does that suggest? All right. It symbolizes an end of the old law, and the way into the most holy place is now made possible through this sacrifice. That makes sense? Because the veil separated the sanctuary from the most holy place, which is compared to heaven. The way into heaven is now made possible through this sacrifice. Not only that, what else happened? Not mentioned here, Matthew mentions dead arose, there were graves that were opened, and something else happened. Rocks were split. So you can imagine there's darkness over the face of the earth, rocks are split, the veil is, and people had to go running around telling, the veil just ripped from top to bottom. I've never seen anything like it. And rocks are splitting. Oh, here's people that died that are walking around now. And there was a centurion there, said what? This is the Son of God. That was the goal of the book, by the way, of this book of Mark. Mark started on that note in Mark 1, drove to that conclusion in chapter 8. Remember that? Started on that note, drove to that conclusion, and now here at the end of the book, truly he was the Son of God. Interesting connection. All right, mentions those that were had come along. There was Mary, and Mary the mother of James the Less. That may mean he's younger or smaller. That's just a way of differing him from another James, Joseph, and Salome. And they followed him. And so there's always a group of women that followed him. I'm driving to the burial because we got a couple of minutes to go. I'm going to skip that for the moment. And let's go to the burial now. Verse 42 to 47. This preparation day that's mentioned at verse 42 is the day before. It's preparation for the Sabbath. John tells us this, that they go around breaking the legs of those that are crucified because they want to clear the cross for the Sabbath. And they came to Jesus and he was already dead. Remember that? Pierced his side. But Mark doesn't tell us that. All right, so this is Friday. So verse 42 identifies this as being on Friday, the day he was crucified. Joseph of Arimathea. Let's talk about Joseph of Arimathea for a moment. Arimathea was about 20 miles from Jerusalem. He was a prominent council member. What council? Sanhedrin. Remember, I asked you a question. Reckon the council all agreed? They didn't. Because here's a man, Joseph of Arimathea, was waiting for the coming of the kingdom. Luke chapter 23:50. Let's see. Let's take a look at that just for a moment. Our time's running out, but we need to flag a connection here. Look at Luke 23:50. He was a council member, a good and just man. Hardly a statement you'd make about one who voiced his opinion, this man is guilty and needs to be crucified. So that tells me that he was not in agreement with what the council had said. John, in answer to question number 9, John 19:38 says, indicates he was a secret disciple. In other words, he wasn't open. Did he have enough courage? No. But he was in agreement with who Jesus was. He was a secret disciple. What'd he do in this story here? We're about done. He went and asked for Jesus' body. Pilate wanted to know if he's dead, so he sent the centurion over and found out he'd been dead. He's kind of amazed at that he'd already died, been dead for some time, and granted it to Joseph. And so he took and wrapped it in linen cloth and into a tomb, a new tomb, not mentioned it being new here that he hewn out for himself. I'm harmonizing the parallel accounts. And rolled a door, a stone up against the door. Now, verse 47, before we get through, there's Mary and Mary that observe where he's laid is setting the stage for chapter 16. That's not just an interesting little tidbit, but they observed where did they take the body? It's in that tomb. That's where we're going to see them coming the early morning of Sunday, not the next day, but even the next, which would be the third day as Jews counted it. Make sense? We're going to have to stop right there.